I had my normal oatmeal and some very strong coffee.
How do you take your porridge?
Oh, I take my porridge. I use Northern Ireland porridge, actually whites.
There is no other porridge.
No, it is.
I love white.
It's the best. Yeah. So we use that. And I'm very fortunate that they're my sponsors as well. So they keep me well stocked. Yeah.
And are you a speedy cook guy? Or are you a jumbo oat man?
No, we actually mix a little bit and we mix it up. We have some speedy cook, like when we're on the move, like, but mostly we're jumbo oats, and Jill makes her own blend for me, like, that we've come to work out that's worked best for me.
Yeah.
So it's really good.
Yeah. There's something special about the jumbo oat. I couldn't give you the nitty gritty science on it, but it hits different. There's something about it. It's nice.
Yeah. Their process is so different to, you know, for actually making the oats. It's a science in its own right.
Yeah.
And I've had the privilege of going through the factory and actually met some of the farmers, the growers themselves.
Wow.
So they're all, you know, they know everyone.
Yeah.
They know all their growers. They interact directly with them. We've been with them now 3 years, I'm with them.
Wow.
It's really good. So I'm hoping maybe they'll stay another year.
I hope so, man. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'm going to say something kind of weird here, but the type of sport that you're involved in, and a lot of other athletes, you're always having to manage the craft with the commerce. Podcasters are the same, you know.
Yeah.
You want to do your thing, which is talking to people, or in your case, get on the bike.
Yeah.
But then there's the whole kind of business component too that you got to juggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sort of blessed, and, you know, Jill is super good at, she handles nearly all of that stuff behind the scenes, because my day is so consumed with training and recovery and all of that other stuff. So I'm just plugging into all the stuff that she has put in place and whatever. Like, but it's a great team. Like, I mean, we enjoy it. There's times it gets stressful. Don't get me wrong. It's like, it's like everyone, like, you know, we live in a stressful environment a lot of the time because of the nature of what we do. We travel the world and we're doing it out of bags, and, you know, we're trying to have life as well. So to manage racing, business, personal life, you know, not have catastrophic divorce papers and things like that. Right, sometimes it can be difficult, like, but we make a pretty good job of it. I would go as far as to say we're, and globally, in the sport that we're involved in, we're very unique, and and people know who we are because of that dynamic of
absolutely
the two of us together, like, and we continually keep making it up, like, so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, as you say, in the bio you sent through and stuff, you know, it really is, it's Team Joe Barr, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, it's what I do is a solo sport, like, but it's not achievable without the group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I know enough about sport, individual sport, to know that there has got to be something that is solid beside that, because at the end of the day, you don't live in that world. Sometimes it's not real, and you need something that's solid and stable to come back to and be, and also to keep you in check.
Sure.
Because it's very easy to let your mind, you know, run off to what's not real. And that's something, like, I really get a lot of that from Jill, like, and that's really good. You know, she'll keep me in check if she sees me starting to, you know, think things that's not true or whatever. And also vision as well, because when you're actually in doing what you're doing, having a different perspective on it is also really important. Like,
So
when we're in the, that's no different to when we're in the races, because we're in the races, Jill actually will see a different perspective to the situation that I'm in than I've got. And there comes a point, believe it or not, and when you go over distance the way I go over it, you know, if you look at something like Race Across America, where you're on the bike consistently for 12 days and nights, nonstop, there comes a point in that, you know, I can't tell you how many changes comes in both your body and your mind.
Yeah.
So what you look like on day one and what you look and sound like on day three and four is completely different. Day five, even different again. Day six, and so on, so forth.
Yeah.
Like that. So having someone to have a conversation with you that makes sense. So we actually have formulated our own vocabulary where rather than me giving an accurate answer to Jill, because that's what I'm thinking, we have this sort of scale where she'll go to me on a scale of 1 to 5, where are you? And she knows exactly what 3 is, and she knows exactly what 4 is, and she knows exactly what 1
like
is.
A traffic light.
And I know the same. So we're not miscommunicating information, which is something that happens all the time in our sport, where you have, and for my sport, the rider, communicating what they think is happening to the team and an ask format to say, I would want you to do this, or I want to do this, or whatever, when in actual fact, that's not really what you're asking at all, and it's misinterpreted, so they come back with it. So the whole thing starts to slowly fall apart. Yeah.
Can you give an example of that?
I think that in the earlier days, because I have radio in, right, so effectively car to radio, I don't talk an awful lot. And the reason for that is because by the end of 12 days, I couldn't breathe. So effectively, I don't talk a lot. They sometimes have to come on the radio and go, are you okay in there? Yeah, I'm okay. So, but, you know, an example would be where I think probably a good example actually would be 2019 Race Across America. A day from the finish, sort of. Race is 3,100 miles long, right? So at about 2,900 miles in, I started to get to a point where I actually started to believe that I couldn't finish the event. Mm. And my language changed, so it became I couldn't, I can't, this is too difficult, or I'm sore here, or that's happening, or whatever. And, you know, I think it was a great example of the way that Jill and I work, where you know, we stopped on the side of the road, and it's a point for the competitor, the rider, you know, where they can't believe in their own capability anymore. You know, you can't believe. Her question to me was, have you been here before?
Oh, wow.
And which my answer was, yes, I was. And she says, well, if you've been here before, then it's okay for you to stop believing. If you don't believe, that's okay. Let's suspend the disbelief, she mm-hmm. said. So let's neither believe or disbelieve. And she left it at that. She asked me, did I want a coffee? She left it at that. So what really happened was, as the competitor, you fall into this void in the middle. And the term I've attached to it now is freedom, because you get unshackled from the pressure.
Interesting.
And what happened for me was, they just let me be, because Race Across America has a shut-off time. So if you don't make it, if you're 1 minute over the shut-off time, you're a DNF after 3,000 miles of racing. So, you know, at that point, I was well inside the shut-off, but I was telling myself, you know, I call it the inner dialogue was going on. Like, so I was having a conversation where myself, telling myself, because I was miscalculating the distance versus my riding output, that I couldn't make the shut-off.
Yeah.
It's not possible for me to do that.
Yeah, yeah,
where in actual fact, I was up a tree. I was way off Dualia, right? But, you know, the outcome of it all was, after a period of that unshackling, or, you know, I call it freedom, where the team took, they get involved in the decision making, even though they're not, and they offload that pressure and they take that away from you. And that's when a really good team know how to actually extract that pressure away from you.
It's like you've outsourced the brain, you know, absolutely. In some ways, absolutely. So you can be the legs in that moment. Yeah.
Well, what happens then is, when that pressure comes off you as a competitor, then the next thing that happens is you do what you automatically do every day, which is, for me, is ride the bike. So I just started riding the bike. So, but then what happens is, you eventually go back to your normal, I call it the mode that you would normally train in every day. So this place that I couldn't became a place of, well, this is what I normally do.
Yeah.
And I don't have to worry about all of that, because they're worrying about it
now.
Yeah. And so on and so forth. So the next thing was, everything came back to normal. So that's an example of the team knowing how to get in and how to do. And we also have a very democratic organization of how we actually speak to each other on the team. So what we try to do is, when I started in it at the beginning, you know, we almost had a hierarchy where you had a crew chief and you had this and that, and all of a sudden then you had debates that were happening over here, and you had someone over here in a different car saying, well, I don't think that that's right. So you had all of this stuff going on that ended up in a very chaotic environment and usually not really achieving the correct answer. So we stopped all of that. So what we have now is a much more democratic platform where all the skill sets are correct, you know, physio, you know, nutrition, drivers, navigators, weather people, they all talk on the same platform, so that they're all bringing their skill sets together, and it's at an equal point, you know. So if we've got tornadoes going across the road, you know, all of a sudden physio will go, well, okay, well, let's put him to sleep. So his sleep break is 5 hours away. We'll bring that forward and make him sleep now. We miss the tornado. So all of a sudden, the smooth pattern starts to come together. Yeah.
I love that, man. What an insight. I mean, I think endurance racing is a completely different beast, but to see, to get a glimpse into the ops behind that is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the distance is mind-boggling. It's very difficult for the person on the street to actually comprehend that you can perform, let that be running or bike, or I'm talking bike in my world, where you can perform continually over those levels of hours and levels of days and nights and days and nights and what that all brings. Like, but it's incredible, you know, the journey that I've come on at the beginning. I was one of those people, and I came from mainstream sport. Like, that's not possible, right? But as you actually start to work and understand, that's what made it so intriguing and so interesting for me. You know, I call it I'm on this journey, it's a lifetime apprenticeship. Like, it's just like, I'm never ever going to get to be the guy. I'm just always going to be on an apprenticeship. And I can see that now, because every event I go to, two things always happen. I always learn something from the event I've been in, and I always realize at the finish of it that further is more possible.
Wow.
So whenever I started at the start, I used to think Race Across America was just something that was a story.
Like Greek gods. You know, this mythical thing.
I never ever see the end of that. That's not possible. How do you go from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean and not stop? That's not possible. But it is possible. And, you know, some of the guys, you know, I've been very fortunate. I've got to the higher levels of them, not at the absolute tip of it.
Sure.
But the absolute tip of that can cross America in 7.5 days. You could barely drive that.
Yeah, that's carnage.
Right. You know, but, you know, for me, at the level I was at, I got into it quite late you know, and I mean, at my age now, like, I'm sort of defying the logic that you can perform at the age I am, at this level. But I've come to realize that the human body is just such an incredible tool that if you manipulate it and feed it and talk to it correctly, it'll keep performing. It'll keep responding to the ask. It's all about all of those mechanics of all of that question put together in the correct formula that allows it to move forward. And, you know, even when you think that, another day isn't even possible, you know, you chunk it down. We call it eating the elephant a slice at a time, where, you know, people say 3,000 miles. You go, well, I don't think like that. I just think as far as the piece that I can see, and I deal with that piece, and then I deal with the next piece. And you piece it all together like that. And over the last 12 years, like, you know, we've won endless amounts of World Cup races around the world. And finished Race Across America a number of times. Brilliant. And it's just, you know, it's something I could never have even imagined 12 years ago as possible. Yeah. And here it is. And, you know, I keep thinking, you know, is further again even more possible and so on and so forth. Like, so
talk to me about those 12 days. Like, I'm sure you get asked a variation of this question quite a lot. But where does your mind go, or where do you go on a race that length?
It's like a whole lifetime in one event, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have all these different experiences. Like, I mean, the experiences of something like Race Across America for someone like who's, you know, most people nowadays have been to the tips of America because it's easy to access west and east or whatever. But when you really go through the United States or right across the midsection of it and stuff, you know, the wildlife, the environment is just mind-blowing. And people say to me, well, you know, do you really take time to look at all of this? And you're going, of course I do.
what else are we going to be doing?
You know, it's right in your face. Like, you know, like a sunset and a sunrise in the Arizona desert, whenever it's right on the tip of the edge of the horizon, is just spectacular. Wildlife that you see, you know, I remember one particular incident, like we were in a race, actually it wasn't a race across America, it was in a race in Texas called the Nokum 1000. In Texas, they've got this park, which is probably the size of Ireland. It's called Big Bend Park, right? So we rode 1,000 miles in and we never left the park.
Wow.
Right. So in the nighttime, we actually went through this area of it where it was a ghost town called Dryden. And we left the ghost town and we go right out into the desert. And the wildlife that started to actually, because the car was so unique, you know, the Cerat Volo car with all the flashing lights and all the stuff, and maybe the guys might have had the music on a little bit or whatever. And all these, they were, I thought at the start, I didn't know what it was in the desert right beside me. It looked like dolphins. It was actually a big herd of deer that was actually starting to do this. But then all these other animals seemed to arrive. So we went through this section of about 100 miles to a place called Fort Stockton with this herd of different animals that was just following us through the night. Like,
incredible.
I remember Jill out the window, you know, taking pictures of it and stuff like that. I mean, it was just incredible stuff like that. And you meet the most incredible people in the journey. I think that for me is one of the biggest highlights. You know, I often think about in 2014 or 2012, actually, in Race Across America, I stopped in a little town in Indiana called St. Mary's that had a population of 28 people. Right. And we stopped and the motorhome was parked and whatever. And so the guy, there was a house and a bar, and the guy who was the barman was also the fireman and so on and so forth. But there was, the thing about it, I think it was relevant for this conversation, is there was this incredible church in it. And it always reminded me actually of Northern Ireland, because here we have a lot of red brick still, mm-hmm. as we have here in this area.
Yeah.
There was this incredible red brick church, and everywhere was immaculately, the grass was immaculately cut and whatever. So I went around the back just to have a quick look around the church. I mean, it looked fantastic. Big plaque at the back of it. And it was actually a Presbyterian minister from Belfast that actually that built that church in St. Mary's. And I made this connection with the town, the little village or whatever. And every year that we go through, we stop in the town and they have a big celebration or whatever. Wow. Like, so, because the race goes through the same time. But we were the first, in all the years of Race Across America, and it's 40 years old, the event, we were the first team rider ever to stop in that village.
Incredible.
And it was just ironic that all of those things were in place and made great friends. Like, and to be honest, I have a litany of stories that's exactly the same as meeting people that just came out to help, or, you know, people would come out alongside of the road. Like, I remember crossing the bridge into West Virginia. There's a big metal bridge that you cross over, and there was this lady and her little granddaughter out at the side of the road, big placard on like this here with big shamrocks and all on it. And she'd been following me from 2012. Class. And she says, I just wanted to bring my granddaughter out. So I stopped and signed some pictures and stuff like that. So you have things like that happen along the road. Like, so it was really good.
Incredible.
Yeah. And we also had some ladies bring in Missouri, and it was really hot. Because their sections in Race Across America are ridiculously hot. Bring us out a box of, you know, like frozen ice lollies, long frozen ones.
Brought out
a box of those to the team and stuff like that. Incredible. So you have things like that happening. Like, so it's really, really good. Like.
Very cool. And to think that you could have missed out on all that when you retired. It's not crazy.
The thing about it is, right now I'm on my second career of sport, but there is nothing in the first half. Absolutely nothing in the first half, except maybe one thing. And I won a Commonwealth medal in 1986 for Northern Ireland, and that would be the big highlight for me. But nothing in that first part of my career even resembles the second part. It's just an incredible journey. Like, every day I get out of bed going, what's today going to bring?
It
just never ends. And, you know, the races are continual, and we've built up such a great presence now across the world, like, especially in the US. I mean, we race a lot there, so we do. We've already been there like twice already this year, and probably another two to go.
Nice.
So we do a lot there. So we, as a small Irish team, we've managed to get ourselves into this position globally, and it's been great. 2017, I won the World Championship, and, you know, as I say, we've won acres of races, so it's just been really But the journey and the people has just been absolutely incredible.
Class. I just finished a book. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called The Second Mountain. And it's this idea where there's two mountains in life.
Yeah.
And the first mountain, like, I'm going to kind of butcher this, but kind of takes you to like your 50s.
Yeah.
You know, like you do the young man stuff. You get the ego out of the way. You know, you get the house. Yeah. You have a few kids. You kind of have the career. And then you have this opportunity, and that's the key word, opportunity to embark on this second mountain, or as you've said it, the second career.
Yeah.
And so many people miss it.
Yeah.
Because we kind of are from a culture where it's like, oh, sure, you know, you retire and you do whatever you do and you're retired. Why did you embark on that second mountain, or what started you off on that second career?
Well, it's not actually how most people would think, because obviously we're talking sport and we're talking performance. Like, you know, the second one thing before I answer your question, I just also want to say about the second part of my career, or that I call it now, like, it has been the greatest opportunity for me to actually become a better person.
Wow.
That's probably, if someone said to me, what's the key thing it has brought for you outside of the sport, because everybody sees the sport.
Sure.
But for me, it has brought a huge amount of better quality of everything, better quality of how I deal with life, better quality of how I interact with people, just everything in general. It has just transformed how I actually behave in the world, because where I came from, I lived life very good on two wheels, but I didn't live life very well on two feet.
Interesting.
I struggled with that. So to go back to your question, how I actually got into endurance racing, you know, most people say, oh, bored, this, that, whatever, needed some big excitement, whatever. Not true. I had, you know, like when I retired, I got married and I had two children, and my second son, Ross, was born, and 5 months into his journey, he was born, he was diagnosed with a stage 4 brain tumor in his brain stalk. He was only a baby. Like. So I got literally on one Wednesday morning from 11 o'clock in the morning until 3 in the afternoon, I just got plummeted into the cancer ward. That was one part of it. The second part of it was probably the most important part of it, because everything that I knew in life and understood in life stopped instantly. I didn't even realize it at that time, because there was like an overrun for a while for me to realize, you know what, none of that matters anymore. That's just all history and done, and it's not. So after about 14 months in the journey with him, I was here in Belfast at the in the Royal Victoria Children's Hospital, who very kindly done all they did. And by the way, I'm going to also say to my son is still alive, right? He has he's still alive. He made it. Like, he's
incredible.
He's 14 years old now. Like, but
wow, what an origin story for him as well. Like,
yes,
the journey for him. Like,
we went down. There was a little respite centre down in Newcastle, in County Down, right at the bottom of Slieve Donard, and I reluctantly went down there, because at that point, after 15 months in it, I was really done with the cancer discussions and talk, and it's such a cruel world where tomorrow doesn't even resemble what today is. And so I got a little bit tired, but however, I did go, and it was just a little detached bungalow that a lady had very kindly donated and whatever. So two or three families go down, and it was the concept was to rebuild the, you know, the family unit again that was completely decimated, like, because you know, in my case, we also had another son at home, and he was only 2 years old. So, you know, we were all split up.
Sure.
And we were no different to any other family that's in that situation, right? So that queue is a very long queue. It's around 30 families a month currently. So that's one a day. That's where it is. Even though we sit here now, someone today is in that situation. And I went down anyhow, and on the wall, they had this big set of plans that was for and it was a vision at that point to build a facility that would cater for 26 families at that time. Currently know it as Daisy Lodge.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. And at that time, there was a lot of stuff happening, and they were really struggling to get the founds in before the planning permission ran out, and all of that stuff was going on. I don't know all the detail of it, like, but that's what was going on. So my introduction to endurance racing was, how can I do an event to contribute to this system that has helped me and my family?
Mm-hmm.
And I could see quite a lot, even in the hospital. Like, you know, the first day you go in there, well, where am I going to stay? They go, oh, you're here on the floor between those two beds. You can have that floor section.
Yeah.
So literally lying on the floor in the hospital. And all the parents were lying on the floor. So you see a crack there and you go, right, we need to try and do something to try and fix that. So, and you go through that process. So anyway, I decided that I would do a sporting event, try and raise some money. And ironically, Ireland had, one of the guys had been from Dublin, had gone to do Race Across America or whatever, and he had made an approach to actually run a race in Ireland called the Race Around Ireland.
Mm.
Got it accredited with the World Body, and it was the first introduction of endurance racing to Ireland.
Wow.
It was called the Race Around Ireland. It was in 2009, and it circumnavigated anti-clockwise the complete outer perimeter of Ireland, starting in Kells, County Meath.
Incredible.
And finishing there. And I seen it. I was in the hospital here in Belfast, and I seen this advertisement for this, and I went, it's five or six. I was sort of rough counting in my head. I went, it's maybe 5 or 6 days of exposure or not, right? So I sort of lobbied everybody to, you know, and I spoke, actually, at that time, I remember contacting Stephen Watson. Stephen at BBC put me in contact with one of his colleagues, and we made a documentary about it anyway. But I went to race around Ireland in 2009, got into a race that I knew nothing about. It had the world champion, all these names and all, meant nothing to me, really. All I was there to do was to fundraise and try and see if I could get myself around this thing, like whatever. Rang every person that I knew under the sun and more or less bullied them in to come and help me.
Sure, yeah.
I had this huge group of 18 people helping me to try and get me around Ireland. Motorhomes and all of that stuff, people donated and stuff. And but, you know, the race itself transpired that the long story short is that after 1,000 miles, this new venture for me, this fundraising thing, became a battle with me and the world champion. And when we got to the bottom of Ireland, I ended up that his name is Fabio Biasalo, and he's actually a very good friend now. Like, and I got into this battle with him, and he was world champion at the time, and ended up anyway. He retired from the race in Cork with exhaustion, and I went on one race around Ireland.
My
first go,
goodness.
So I have to say, I'm the first person to say I couldn't even write the script for that. But that's the script. That's the script I ended up with. And I won that. And BBC made a fantastic documentary about the charity and whatever. You know, the rest of it's history. For me, they went on, that facility went on and built, and we now have Daisy Lodge, and it looks after 26, and I've just got involved in another project where they're building another one in Cong in County Mayo.
Incredible.
You know, so that story, that's how I got in. And I qualified, because it was a World Cup race, I qualified for Race Across America and Race Around Ireland, and that's how I got in 2012.
Mate, that's the domino, is it?
Yeah, it just sort of incredible. Went from a fundraiser to something that got me into competitive racing again, and I went to 2000. I didn't finish in 2012. I almost lost my life in the Rockies, which was another aspect of the whole thing.
What was that, altitude? Or
I had altitude sickness.
Yeah.
But a very severe case of it. And Race Across America, because you go across two deserts, first of all, so it's incredible heat, and then it goes in like to 12,000 feet elevation. It's how you manage the hydration in the desert that impacts going up or whatever. For me, both of those things were crash and burn situations. And at the top, it's a place called Wolf Creek Pass. It's actually where the Great Divide, you literally ride across the Great Divide. And when you crest over at the top of it, pretty barren up there, nothing. But when you drop down to about 9,000 feet, there's a little village called South Fork, not related to Dallas or anything like that, but little village there, and it has an incredible hospital. And luckily for me, I got in there, and I had a window of about 4 hours where it was pretty touch and go. It was pretty severe, and I got away with it. And that was, you know, that was the realization that now we're in the big league here.
Yeah.
And we now need to treat this seriously. And you had asked an earlier question about, you know, when did the team start? That was the real decisive moment as to where I realized I needed specific skill sets. I needed, you know, people put together in such a way that we could actually do this, because what had happened in Race Around Ireland and where this is completely two different
places.
And that was the start of it. We slowly molded from 2012, because the qualification lasts for 3 years. So from 2009 to 2012, took me that period of time to get the funding and get the people and try to figure out Race Across America from here. Got there, you know, I have to say it was incredibly expensive and made a lot of mistakes. And, you know, the race almost cost me my life. And that also makes you sit up and go, hang on a minute here, do I really need to be doing this? And so on and so forth. But that was more my poor management than it was anything. And so, you know, that could have been it was probably the biggest failure for me because it was very public and it was very, very difficult. But I also had, like, took 6 months roughly for me, you know, physically to be able to get myself recovered and say to myself, right, okay, what am I actually going to do here?
Sure.
So it really became a question of resilience at that point. Mm-hmm. So I had also said to you there that it had changed me as to how I interact with the world and how I am in the world and whatever. Like, and it really made me sit up and go, you know what, this, I'm not living the fiasco. I either am or I'm not going to do this.
Yeah.
And I went back again in 2014 and I finished second in the category and 10th overall. So I did a lot of homework in those 2 years. And, well, not even 2 years, about a year and a half, really.
Yep.
I did a lot of homework there. And then between times, we did an awful lot of other things. One of the key aspects to do what I do is you really need to be able to stay on your bike for 50 hours without getting off. That's a huge chunk. For anyone to comprehend how you do that, it's difficult. Same for me.
Yeah, I tell you what, I used to work for Deliveroo, right, on the bicycle, yeah. And I thought doing a 12-hour shift was rough. I'm like going up the Newton Arch Road, and I'm like, flip sake, this hill's brutal.
No. It's on a whole different scale of that. But I get where you're coming from. You know, it's that same concept, like, you know, and you take it and you just make it.
But cute. even just for your arse to be on the saddle that long, that's brutal.
There's an awful lot of stuff you got to go through, and you know, I've just come from a race there, like, where I almost lost the soles of my feet. Where you say to yourself, well, why do you want to suffer through that? Well, no one does. It just happens.
Yeah.
You know, we were in an extreme situation where it's like 122 degrees. So it's, you know, it's extreme. And you're doing it continually. So there's no place that you can say, right, I'm getting off here.
Yeah. But like, let me dip into the cryo chamber here real quick.
I always draw on one big thought around that whole situation, you know. Like that race there, we've just come back from where that happened to me. You know, I've still broken the course record for my age category, and I also won the age category, and I finished fourth overall.
Wow.
So, you know, had the feet thing not happened, I'd have finished second overall.
Sure.
But I always draw on one thing from that, and it was actually back whenever I was, you know, when I started the very first event, that Race Around Ireland event. Because it was a fundraiser or whatever, I was very much focused on what was happening. You know, every day in that race, like, I was still asking, you know, how's things at the hospital? Is everything okay? Because Ross was still in the hospital. Like, and you become part of that world. Like, you almost go, well, how's the wee boy next door? Or how's the wee girl? Yeah. You become part of that. So you want to know what that is. That's your world. Sure. The rest of the stuff's non-existent at that point. So I was very much involved in that. So I became very conscious of one thing, and that was, you know, I used to watch after sessions of chemotherapy what would happen, even with my own son, like, where they'd be incredibly sick afterwards. Yet and all, when that would pass, the next thing that would happen is they'd just be smiling and just want to get on with life. And the next day they get up and do it again. And the reason they're getting up and doing it every day is because they can't put it down. They can't walk away. They can't get up. They can't stop.
Sure.
So I always carried that concept to go, you know, no matter what happens here, I'm getting up tomorrow and we're going to take this on again. And that's where the idea of chunking it down, because if I deal with this bit now, I know tomorrow's coming. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I'll deal with this bit today and I know it'll come.
Yeah.
And that's, the race is exactly the same for me. You know? Yeah. Like, it's that same concept that I use.
It's really interesting that you draw on that. Yeah.
I think it's intense, but it's you get, that becomes part of the whole DNA of where, so I never lose sight of where I started. Which is also part of, like, you know, the conversation we had there around, you know, Jill and myself having our own conversations, where to stay grounded and, you know where you come from and know what created that and know why you're doing this and have purpose and do all of that. So we do as much as we can, events like, you know, still to contribute to the whole process of that we can. And I get a lot of enjoyment out of that. I really do. Because I know it's like you said, some people, when they do things, they don't really know what that achieved or what it did or how it impacted or whatever. I actually do. I'm one of the people who actually know what that is.
Yeah.
So whenever I'm doing something, I know where the end point of that is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it a lot more worthwhile for me. Like, it gives me this connection that's grounded in that world and not something that's out in the ether.
Yeah.
So
you've got something very tangible.
Absolutely.
That you're racing for.
Absolutely.
You know,
and they're not all like that. They're not all like that, but the ones that are like that still bring that same environment for me. Like, and it's good. And I get a lot of enjoyment out of it, to be truthful. I did a big one in America in 2014 as well, like, and it was just incredible. I never met any of the kids at all. There was 12 of them, one for every day. And they were all over America everywhere. And you know, we contributed to their families, like, and it was just great.
It's great. I'm really interested in this idea that you've kind of revealed, again, between the first career and the second career.
Yeah.
You said you live life well on two wheels, but not well on two feet.
Yeah.
Unpack that a wee bit for me. Like, is it a case that was cycling a form of escapism for you? Like, you used a lovely phrase. I don't know if we were rolling, but the picture I kind of had in my head was, you said it's not real when you're on the bike. And just yesterday I had family from Australia and Germany over, and we did this virtual reality thing, right, on a bike.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how it's just not real, you know. You're literally escaping reality.
Yeah.
And I can relate to that. Like, I have a past of addiction and, you know, a lot of escapism behavior that I've had to kind of fight my own demons to come through. But even this, what we're doing, I love this immensely. This is my sport.
Yeah.
But it's not real. Do you know what I mean? Like, like the red button goes off and we go out of here, and then you've got family and I've got work and I've got, you know, my real world.
Yeah. Well, I think when I say it's not real, like, you know, the world, the normal world that everyone lives in, when I'm on the bike, like, I had an example of it this year, like, when I rode through Monument Valley, just when the sunset's coming down.
Yeah.
Literally. I rode hard to make sure that I got there. I rode hard to make sure. Because I've been in Monument Valley three times in the darkness and I've never seen it.
You're like, I'm not letting this happen again.
I'm not letting it happen this time. Like, I'm definitely going to see it. But, you know, the rest of the world, all the bad and the good that's happening in the globe at the moment is nothing, because you don't know what's going on. For the last X number of days and nights, it's been silence. There's been total silence. You don't know anything about that. All you know about is what the vision you have in front of you, and the fact that there's a team in the car and the radio. It's just the basic things that are there. The rest of it's not existent. So that's why you feel like it's not real.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're in this place and no one can see you.
Yeah.
But the reality is, everyone can see you, like, you know, because they're on live feeds, you know, talking to the world. But for me, it's different. For me, I'm sitting there, like, going, and I'm just in this little bubble by myself.
Helmet on, the visor's forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, we don't use any kind of, you know, music or anything like that. It's just complete silence. Like, in the nighttime, it is complete silence. You can hear all the critters on the side of the road and whatever. It's incredible feeling, and I really like that. But, you know, I wouldn't say it's an escapism. I mean, I love, like, I get excited. I can't help myself. I just get excited whenever I know we're going racing, like, and to some of the places that we go to get to do it in as well, it's just a great privilege. Like. I take that privilege as a privilege.
Sure.
You know, and do my absolute best with it. But in the early days, I think that one of the things that mainstream sport did for me was it started to mold me into this goldfish in a goldfish bowl that continually just went in this vicious circle.
Yeah.
Same language, you know, same conversations, different day, whatever. And for the same reason, the rest of the world is outside the fishbowl. Right?
Wow.
Right, because no matter where you go, it's the same circuit, the same people, different location and whatever, and you're moving around and your whole vocabulary and your world becomes this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You do it as long as I did it. Whenever you decide that you're coming out of that fishbowl, that's like someone leaving you on the moon with no air and no way home. That's what that feels. That's what that felt like for me.
Yeah.
And I try to integrate with the outside world. You know, you look around, you go, right, what am I supposed to look like here? What makes me fit into this thing? Because I don't fit in here. I don't even, you know, I don't live life like this. You know, I go to bed at 9 o'clock. I eat like this. I train like that. I'm continually watching performance and you know, people are saying, oh, we're off to the pub then. Are you coming? Or, you know, I couldn't fit into that.
Yeah.
So I had to ask myself, what is it I need to look like to fit in there? Mm. And that was the start of my problem, because I felt I needed to look a certain way to fit into that.
Yeah.
So I slowly gave up my own identity as to who and what I was.
Sure.
Right. But then I became in this place of no man's land, because I was neither in the bowl or out of the bowl.
You were neither fish nor man. You neither were some fish. weird mutant in between.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that becomes a very difficult place if you're trying to become part of something. There's times I felt that it was desperation. I was trying to cling on to. So, you know, for me, I did what I thought was the thing to do, get the job, get married.
Sure.
Do the whole.
Tick the boxes.
Do the whole piece.
Is it working yet?
Do the whole piece, right. Did all of that to realize, unfortunately, no, that's not the answer for me. And I was there was a lot of regret in that. Don't get me wrong. A lot of regret and a lot of stuff I still carry from it that I work through. But then, you know, I sort of decided that I have to become myself. I have to be who I need to be, because I can't be anything until I'm that.
That's a thing, yeah.
And that's exactly, you know, what happened. And that the journey of ultra racing was one of the biggest catalysts that actually started to transform that and change it. And, you know, ironically, whenever I was professional rider back in the early 90s was when I met Jill in the early 90s. And for 25 years, we went off on our own lives and whatever. And she's had a fantastic career and whatever. But after 2014 Race Across America, we connected again, and she was in Calgary in Canada. And obviously I had just finished in US, and I went to Canada to see her. And after all of this time, we connected again, and eventually we've ended up where we've ended up. Yeah. So the crossroads for me was, back then, I just didn't realize it.
Mm.
And it took me to there. But from that point, from 2015 to now, even though there was, you know, you could sit and say there were so many bad things about the lockdown and all of that stuff that came for, and it's hurt so many people, I don't feel like that. You know, it was just one of the greatest things, like, because it allowed me to actually really work on myself, work on my relationship with Joel and life in general.
Yeah.
And what came out of that was I had the opportunity to write an autobiography.
Class.
So, you know, so, and I think that, you know, just talked about many times, but, you know, when Jill and I talked about it, the first thing that came was that I could actually sit down now and say what I really need to say,
mm-hmm.
and not feel that I'm not here, or I'm not in that bowl, or I'm not in this camp, or whatever, because it was just my story.
Yeah.
And that was the, I got a lot of pleasure out of that without being horrible to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to write down what the journey was from the beginning to where it is right now,
and
hopefully left enough room that there's a sequel.
Well, that's the thing, you know, I was going to say with the autobiography, you know, you're into your second career here, and you've got a good bit to go. So you're going to have to do a refresh in a couple of decades, probably.
I don't know about a couple of decades. I don't know if I've that much left. Like, but I certainly have a little bit left. Like, but it was funny the way it came around. I was literally sitting in my friend's house in Washington D.C. I just finished Race Across America, and I came from the finish line in my race kit after 12 days of racing, and I wasn't even standing. I was sitting in the base of the shower in his house in D.C. And Jill came up and says, you know, BBC wanted to do an interview with you back home or whatever. So I said, okay, I'll do the interview.
You're like, can you give me a week?
Do the interview anyway. Like, and it was a very good interview. And anyway, ironically, the gentleman that did it was actually from here, from Northern Ireland.
Brilliant.
And his name is Robin Sheeran. And about a month later, maybe 2 months later, he contacted me to say, he says, all the guys in my office said I should write a book about you. How do you feel about me writing a book about you? And that's literally how it came about.
Amazing.
And I met him here in Belfast, actually, and we set off to write a book.
Class.
And we were very fortunate that we got Gill Publishing in Dublin took it on and published it, one of the top publisher in Ireland.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole process of it was very, very interesting. It was a great process for me on a personal level.
Yeah, tough, but...
Well, we did it on lockdown.
nice to reflect, you know, like it's sometimes you need that intentional force you to look back and contemplate things.
It was uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's powerful.
It was uncomfortable. Like, but again, I think that if you want to move forward, you've got to be able to just accept the uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about it a lot in our racing where it's being comfortable in the uncomfortable. Right. And that's where we strive to get to from a performance point of view. But yeah. I think that the book thing was no different because, I mean, I came from a very small village in Donegal, actually. I was born in Dublin, but I grew up in Donegal and, you know, made my way there around the world, like, to race, whatever. Mm. So there was a lot back then, you know, like I started in 1972. That's a long time ago. And, you know, so the world is very different now.
Sure.
For obvious reasons, like, you know, but the troubles were here and there was a lot of stuff happening that wasn't good, like, and I spent a lot of time here in Belfast in the early days. So I did, like, so it was, you know, the whole journey. People go, oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So that part of it has been really good, and it's been very well received here, and the book has been really well received in the US too. Like, so it's been good.
Okay.
It's been a really good journey.
Couple of quicker questions.
Yeah.
Similar sort of theme, but I do kind of want to dig into this a wee bit. In a few words, and no pressure, like, take as long as you want. But how would you describe the difference between Joe in the first career and the second career on a personal level? Like, what's changed? You talk about how it's changed you, especially, you know, the endurance in the second career.
I've come to realize that the world doesn't owe me.
Mm.
That's the first thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't owe me anything. I used to think in sport, like especially when you start to win or whatever, that you deserve something.
Mm-hmm.
So my work ethic has never changed. I've always had a huge work ethic, but how I actually interact with people now has changed drastically, like, because I was very much an introvert and I just kept myself to myself and whatever. That came a lot from just the early days. You know, I grew up in a home that wasn't, let's say, your normal home, and there was a little bit of violence in it and stuff like that. So, you know, I carried a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think the main thing was the main thing that came out of that situation was that you didn't have any self-worth. And right now, you know, I know my own worth right now.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the bit that has changed. Like, you know, I know who I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any problem saying who I am. Whereas before, I would have almost shied away from that and not talked about it.
Sure.
And whatever. So it left me socially very awkward. I never really fitted into groups and whatever. So I was always very much a loner and always on my own, always cutting my own trough and doing my own thing. But, you know, the other thing is as well, like, never really grounded as such, always on the move.
Yeah.
You know, just following the next race and whatever. Whereas now it's very, very different. Like, it's a much more enjoyable period in my life, really. It's not as turbulent. And, you know, I'm grateful for everything that I've got out of it, and I'm grateful for everything that I know will still come in it. Like, so it's definitely changed me pretty much in every aspect of life.
Yeah,
in every aspect.
No, I appreciate you going there, because I just look at you, and someone said this in here the other day. It was a French phrase. I'm not going to try to actually, you know, redo
with
French.
Your best Belfast accent.
Yeah. I always love the je m'appelle in school. It's so classic. But I look at you, and the short time I've been with you, even in the coffee shop and everything, you know, you're someone, and this is relatively rare, you're someone who actually looks comfortable in their own skin.
Thank you.
And that's...
I am.
That's powerful. And for me, actually, like, look, the cycling's amazing. I'm blown away.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But the most impressive thing is the way you actually carry yourself. And I even want to commend you for that, because I think that's the hardest mountain to climb, you know?
Thank you for saying that. Yes, that is one thing that is for sure. Like, I'm not here to impress anyone anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to be anything other than just what I am.
Yeah.
And that's a really good thing about it is, I think that, you know, the truthfulness and the honesty of it all is the part where you don't have to live behind a charade and live up to something that's not real. And, and all of that stuff, that becomes very, very tiring. And, you know, I always went through a phase a lot where I was so depressed on the inner side. And but yet, no, it was this big charade that wasn't real on the outside. And now I'm not like that. Now, if I have a bad day, I say I'm having a bad day. And I deal with a bad day in a completely different way, you know. And I try to, you know, talk myself through what that day is and what that looks like and how I get out the other side of it, et cetera, et cetera. And not carry it on. And more importantly, not impact the world around me. And that's very, very important, like, you know, because the world we that I exist in on a normal day, like, is a stressful world for the obvious reasons. Like, so, but, you know, we always try to find space in the day where it's not like that. And that's hugely important. Like, so, yeah, definitely very, I would say, comfortable in my own skin is a very good statement.
I don't know if you ever heard the Jim Carrey quote. He's got something class, and that just builds perfectly on what you were saying. He says something like, depression is your body telling you that it's tired of the character you're forcing it to play.
Absolutely.
I think that's wild.
I mean, I went through a big phase of it whenever, you know, whenever the whole thing with my son was over. My marriage ended and all of that stuff all happened. And it was like this just big...
Well, big trauma dump, really.
You know, like, I came back from Race Across America, but I already knew in Race Across America in 2014 it was going to happen because obviously the kids were young and whatever, and I knew all that was going to come. As soon as I got off the plane, there was just going to come this. But what I didn't realize was how far that would spiral downwards, unknowing to me, first of all, and how far it had got to whenever I became really aware of how bad this actually was, you know, to the point where, you know, I had moved into a new home and, you know, another, a rental home. Like, really, it wasn't a new home as such. I moved into a rental home. But literally for 3 years, the only thing that ever opened was the front door when I was going out and in. The blinds were closed. It was complete block to the world. And I lived like that for a long time. And when Jill came, you know, it was the first thing she remarked on, like, you know, we've got to open the blinds and let in some air here. Like, and,
well, that's like... That's like prophetic almost, isn't it? That's like on a metaphorical level, that is powerful.
Well, that's literally what happened.
Wow.
And from that day that she literally opened the blinds when she arrived from Canada, like, I, you know, that was the beginning of me starting to turn from the bottom to come back. So really without her input and this place to have this interaction on the level that I have it, with someone who actually understands the world that I'm in is very unique. And that's what makes us unique. And that's why we get seen the way we get seen. Like, in that, you know, some of the clients that Jill has in her own nutritional coaching business, like, are global. Like, they're from all over the world, everywhere, and a huge amount from the ultra racing world. Like, but they get it. They see what she does with me and how I behave with her. Like, so so there's a spinoff for the business aspect of it that way as well. Like, but I certainly wouldn't be where I am today without that input. That's an absolute truth.
It's great. This seems like a really shallow question now after where we've been swimming the last few minutes, but just like briefly, I'm just curious, you know, you were more of a racer, shorter distance in first career. Just like, talk to me about on a athletic level, like, some of the key differences that you've been surprised by between short distance and ultra.
I think it, well, first of all, the big aspect of ultra distance is the nutritional aspect of it.
Because
you have got to be able to feel distance.
Interesting.
You know, the you have got to obviously have the you know, the physical performance level. If you want to be at the top of it. I think it, the beauty of what ultra racing is, unlike what mainstream is what I call top-end loaded. You know, if you're not in the top three, no one even wants to have a conversation.
That's so true,
Nobody wants to have that conversation. You know, matter of fact, we're almost at the stage in today's world, if you're not winning, no one wants to have the conversation. Who cares? Right? And whoever seconds off to the next race to go, I got to try and be first the next time. So there's that's how short a life it is. And if you won the biggest event that there is, unless it's something that rocks the world, 2 weeks' time, history. No one even remembers. Right. So you're continually chasing this, right? Whereas in ultra racing, there's a place for everyone. There's a place for everyone because not everyone in life wants to actually strive for 1, 2, and 3.
Sure.
But what they do want to do is they want to challenge themselves.
Yeah.
Right. They have their goal. Right. So that's what ultra racing allows them to do. It allows them to have that and not be judged.
Yeah.
Because in a what I call a mainstream competitive event, you're judged between number one to number 10, number 10, number 20.
Yeah, yeah,
where
yeah,
did
yeah,
you
yeah.
finish?
Yeah.
Are you on the first page? You're on the second page.
Yeah.
Right. And ultra racing is just not like that at all. It's a complete opposite to that. And the other thing that I noticed as well, if, you know, whenever in mainstream it's really, really cutthroat where something happens in a race or whatever, big crash, someone punctures, whatever, people go, oh, great, that's another one gone.
Yeah.
They do think like that.
Of course.
They may not say that. But
it's the nature of the game.
Yeah, it's the nature of the game. It's really ruthless. Whereas in ultra racing, if you someone happened to you in one of those big races and a team came from behind and whatever, first thing they'll do is pull over and go, are you okay? Is everything okay here? Can we help or whatever? It's a completely different environment like that. So it is. But don't get me wrong, at the top end of it, like it's very, very, very competitive.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But it drags that same mindset with it. And even the top guys in it are very, very, very supportive of the guys who have their goal set, whatever that is. And that may not even be to be in the top 50 or whatever. And I think it's one of the things that we get a lot of satisfaction out of because people tend to just gravitate to us to ask, how do I do this?
Yeah, yeah.
If I want to do this here, what would be the best thing to do? So
yeah.
I get the opportunity and Jill gets the opportunity to be able to not just help us, but to help other people achieve their goal. And people, we get some of the most incredible emails back to go, thank you so much. Look, I've done this and I've done that and this is what I got. And I've tried for 4 times or 3 times and I could never do it.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that's it. They walk away and go, that's all I wanted to do. So there's a big aspect of that. And so that's the part that's very, very different. It's and I've learned a lot about from the nutrition. You know, mainstream takes you to a certain level of what the ask of the body is. But ultra racing takes you to a whole different level feeling a race that's 6 hours long and feeling a race that's 220 hours long, that's a very different animal.
Yeah. Different solar system.
Yeah. So the bottom line is when you look at a human body, they're all the same.
Mm.
So it's how you interact with that to get it to go forward. So there's been this educational process as well as to understanding, well, if I do this, what happens? If I change that, will this happen? Oh, yes, it does. And you move on. So when, like, in 2009, somebody said to me, race across America 3,001 miles. I would have went, forget about that. Can't do that. Now, if I have that conversation, really, someone said to me, this race is 10,000 kilometers long or whatever. I go, okay. If they went to me, and I've had the conversation, like, you know, where people go, oh, well, what about race around the world? And you go, well, that's 18,000 miles. Yeah, I could do that. You know, there is a different mindset around it now with me.
Yeah.
Because I realize that you can actually manipulate the human body to do pretty much anything you want it to do.
Yeah.
If you feed it correctly and treat it correctly.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as well, the one thing that I would say about it is if you've come from a lifestyle like – I haven't, but if you came from a lifestyle where you mistreated your body over years and years and years and years, that's a very difficult change to make that a very functional, high-performance body.
Yeah.
Very difficult to do that. That was one of the things that was different about me right from my outset.
Sure.
I was just nutritionally oriented.
Yeah.
All the way through. So I'm now, at my age, completely reaping the benefits of that part of it.
Yeah.
And then we're adding all these new pieces to it.
That's great.
As to how we can actually keep taking it forward. Not like, but I don't think really that from a distance point of view, if you want to put it that there's really anything beyond the human body, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of very interesting conversations like this in the group of people that I circulate with.
Yeah, I imagine your dinner table must be the weirdest chats.
We spend so much time traveling in vehicles in the US and whatever. We have all these weird conversations that last for a day. We pick them up a day later and we start up again. But there has been a lot of really big conversations around, you know, where exactly is the limitation of a human body? And in the world that we live in, like that, gets explored a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets explored a lot. And it's not where most people think.
Yeah.
So it's not.
I love that kind of element of inquiry. You know, it's like 18,000 miles. You can even just see it in your eyes. You're almost breaking it down like components. You're like, well, what would we need to do to get, you know, the first 10,000? And after that, what would that happen? You know, and as opposed to just the disbelief that a lot of people would meet that with.
Absolutely. You know, I just agreed, well, that's that. That's Australia. That's across America.
All right, Europe would be easy now. Let's say.
You know what I mean? Yeah. We can get a boat here in China. And, you know, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a whole different concept to how you actually understand it. Like, and I mean, it has been done.
Yeah.
It has been done. Like, so absolutely. It's... it was there's a Scotch lad, Mark Beaumont, has already done it, and I think he done close to 80. I think he was set off to do 80 days around the world. That's really what he wanted to do. I think he ended up with like 78 or something like that. Like, so, you know, I run my own calculations, like, and I always think like it's 74 is possible.
Yep.
So whether we ever get to do that, I don't know. Like, it's you know, it's a project. It's what I call a standalone project.
Yeah.
You know. You need a really good investor who wants to invest in the project and sees the value for them as an investor, sure. And what that is like, to be able to have a very serious effort at it. Like, you know, but you never know. I keep living in hope.
Yeah. Mate, it's the sort of thing that, you know, little company called Netflix could be interested in. And, you know, all that sort of stuff makes things like that more possible. It's very interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. We had Netflix this year at Race Across America. Sweet. They were quite interested in a lad. His English lad, actually, James Golding. Great story as well, like two-time cancer survivor and whatever.
Brilliant.
And went to Race Across America, and Netflix wanted to cover that. Like,
class.
Unfortunately, he didn't get to finish. Like, but you know, the Netflix are now on that page.
Sure.
Well, like,
yeah.
So there's an interest in that type of stuff. Like, but the round the world one is a very, very interesting one.
Like, I like it. Well, I watch the space.
I always like it bobbling around out there, like, you know, just in case it ever pops up.
That exactly.
Maybe I get the opportunity.
Well, you never know who's listening. That's what I always say, you know.
Yeah.
Like, three stock questions, ask everybody, and then I'll let you get out of here, right? First one, totally change pace. If you take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a coffee, who would you take and where would you take them?
That's a toss-up between two people, actually.
Give me your two. That's fine.
George Best and John Hume.
Give me John Hume.
I think that John Hume... Well, I believe that George Best changed sport.
Sure.
Yeah, that's my personal belief. Like, I think that he brought sport to the... Let's call it the slab word.
Yeah.
And I think John Hume brought the start of what Northern Ireland could look like, if we all want to be part of that.
Sure.
I think that, so those are two game changer type people for me. Yeah. Where would I take them?
it's an odd bunch to take somewhere. Like.
Well, that is a very good question. I think I'd take John Hume probably down to a little village called Kildaff in County Donegal.
Yes, I've been.
I think he would like that part of the world. I don't have the same knowledge of George Best, but I kind of think that, you know, not to be too cliche about it, like, but I think that somewhere in County Down maybe would suit him.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe Newcastle.
Love it.
Maybe Newcastle, I think.
Brilliant. If you could go back in time to... This is hard. I usually go for 18 years old, but I might go a wee bit later. When did you start? Race around Ireland, how old were you?
Oh, when I started Race around Ireland, I was like 50 years old or something. Like, so I was
Do you know what? I think, let's go there. If you could go back in time to yourself at 50, and you had a couple of minutes of 50-year-old Joe's time... What sort of things would you say to him?
I would say, here's an opportunity to right all the wrongs.
Mm.
And grab the opportunity and don't ever let go of it.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what I've done, to be honest. It was the time. It was that time of transition. That's really what it was. So, there was a chance to, you know, shape up.
Yeah. Awesome. Final question. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So we'll see where we go. First reaction or first thing that pops into your head whenever I ask, what's the kindest thing that someone's ever done for you?
The kindest thing that someone has ever done for me was probably when Jill agreed to leave Canada and come back home for me, or to come with me. That was probably the kindest thing, because I wouldn't be here without her. It's pretty that simple. Although I have been shown great kindness from my mum, immense kindness. Again, I wouldn't have actually got the first career if it hadn't have been for her. And I certainly wouldn't be where I am. Not the career part of it, but the life part of it without Jill.
Yeah.
That's absolute truth.
Awesome. Joe, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, loved it.
Enjoyed it.
Really loved it.